Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news from Mr. Host at 7 o'clock right now on this day. We kick things off in 1938. What a way back in history on this day. The Treaty of Munich would be signed by three gentlemen in particular, Adolf Hitler, Benito Mussolini, as well as Neville Chamberlain. In addition to that, Eduardo Daladier would also be signing that document, forcing Czechoslovakia to give up some territory to Germany. Very interesting day indeed. In 1939, a year later, Germany and Russia would agree to partition Poland. It seems as though this was a very popular thing to do at that time. In 1955, on this day, James Dean would die sadly in a car crash at the age of 24. In 1960, on this day, the Flintstones would premiere on ABC. 1966, on this day, Botswana would gain its independence from Britain. In 1968, on this day, the company called Boeing would roll out their first ever 747 jet. And on this day in 1991, Jerry Springer would debut, or the Jerry Springer Show, rather, would debut on this day. You're tuning into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha. And on the show today, we take a look at the impact of that Chinese stimulus package that was unveiled last week. It seems as though that has come into the market quite strongly as we start off this week. We're going to speak to Group China economist at Standard Bank, Jeremy Stevens, around that. Then we've got a conversation around the latest bid by the South African Poultry Association to see if we can have, if they can have the certain chicken portions VAT exempted or zero rated by National Treasury. That bid is going to go through soon, or that application rather is going to be put forward soon. Then we've got a conversation around understanding guaranteed annuities. Momentum Wealth will help us unpack that conversation and see if we can make sense of that particular product. Then we've got a conversation as part of our personal finance segment on a Monday around life insurance and understanding the difference between life insurance and education insurance.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Before we get things going, we're going to take a look at how the markets have been moving throughout the day. It's been a very interesting day of movements. I'm joined on the line by Director and Portfolio Manager at Rand Swiss, Gary Boyson, to take a look at the market movements and try and see if we can make sense of them. Good evening, Gary. Lovely to speak to you. U.S. markets, or U.S. dollar actually, starting with the dollar, came back with a vengeance today, causing havoc in the markets. I mean, equities were down, gold prices feeling it as well. It looks as though the U.S. dollar wouldn't give up as we closed out the month.
Absolutely. And I suppose because so many things are priced in U.S. dollars, just when you get a U.S. dollar move like we have today, it feels like everything else is falling when really it's just the dollar getting a bit stronger. If you look at the dollar index, which is a basket of essentially the six biggest trading partners of the U.S., a basket of their currencies against the U.S. dollar, that up about 0.25% for the day. So yeah, that's a big move. It's still down around 1% for the month, but we've seen a lot of dollar weakness feeding through. But as you say, that impacted just about everything from the gold price, which is down just under 1%. Our market also really feeling the pain. Looking at the headline level, the top 40 down around 1.26% at the close. The resources, as you said, really taking the brunt of it, down just under 2%. The financials also down almost 1.5%, while the industrial index was down 0.78%. So every sub-index falling as well. The local currency, so the rand out to 17.24, really bouncing off that 17 rand level. Although it is over 3% stronger for the month. So it just seems, inter-month end, inter-quarter end, I don't know, maybe people are doing a little bit of window dressing. We're just getting a little bit of a kickback on the moves that we see in the month and a little bit of a reversal into the close.
Gary, when we look at that Rand performance, you touched on it now to say that we are still up 3% for the month against the dollar, but we didn't have a better day against any of the other major currencies either. It's seemingly that the Rand gave back some ground against all the majors.
Yeah, and it's interesting because the rand is always going to be the proxy for the kind of emerging market, developed market trade. But there's a lot of reasons that the rand has strengthened as aggressively as it is. So the first is the interest rate differential. So, with the Fed cutting interest rates by 50 basis points and the South African Reserve Bank only cutting by 25, and also if you look at the timing of the meetings going out, over the next 3 months, it does look like there is the potential for that interest rate differential to widen even further. And what that means is, in the simplest terms, for listeners, if you had to put money in a bank account in dollars, you're going to get slightly less, relatively speaking, to what you would have gotten in rand, even accounting for the currency weakness on the aggregate currency weakness. So it's that's the one thing playing into it. But also the idea that last week we had that announcement around the potential for Chinese stimulus, Chinese central bank saying that, potential, well, at least, the RRR requirement was going to come down. They also, their 7-day reverse repo is also coming down. So really a lot of stimulus coming into their market, not just to support their stock market, but to support their property sector as well. That is very good news for commodities. And of course, South Africa is inexorably linked to global commodity markets. So when an economy like China is stimulating, that is naturally very good for a currency like the rand. And the correlation between commodity prices and the rand is well documented, and the correlation is very, very high. So yes, that has been optimistic, and maybe you're seeing a little bit of profit taking on that. But at the same time, we are hearing, I suppose, the political ructions, over the weekend as well. And I think, there's been a lot of optimism around the GNU, and that definitely has fed into the local unit. Also, the fact that we haven't had load shedding has fed into the local currency as well. So maybe again a little bit of profit taking into the end of the month, and everyone looking at kind of just above 17 rand to the dollar and saying, wait a minute, maybe this is a little bit too much, a little bit too quickly, and a little bit of sanity coming back, and a little bit of a natural retracement. Of course, we did, just on the economic front though, we did also get a surprise on our trade account. Surplus narrowing more than was expected. So based on Bloomberg consensus, we're expecting a 19.1 billion rand surplus. We only got a 5.6 billion surplus, which is also a big miss. I didn't see an actual movement on the number, but we have lost to kind of another 7 cents to the dollar after that. So maybe that also feeding into it a little bit.
That could definitely have fed into the local sentiment, especially on the rand side of things. Gary, you touched on the international markets and that Chinese stimulus. Chinese markets having a bolster of a day today, but at the same time, Japanese markets having a torrid day. What's happening internationally?
Yeah, so again, the Chinese stimulus measures are significant for their economy. It's as I said, the RRR cuts, which are essentially the reserve ratio requirements. So it's what the banks in China have to hold in reserve, and essentially what they have to lend out. So China has cut that by 50 basis points. So that is a massive stimulus that will feed into the markets. The 7-day reverse repo, that was cut by 25 basis points. So also another stimulus mechanism that the Chinese authorities can use, and this is all, as I said, very, very positive for commodity markets. And yes, we understand that China has demographic issues. They have a problem in their property sector. We understand. There are plenty of issues around China, but if you go and look at Chinese stocks at the moment, they are just so incredibly cheap. And when you get, I suppose, positive noises from from Chinese authorities saying that they will support the stock market and that they're putting measures in place to support the stock market, it's almost the Chinese equivalent of don't fight the Fed. If the Chinese authorities want Chinese stocks to go up, they're going to go up, and you will see a good day on Chinese markets, or a good couple of days. On the other hand, Japan is in a very, very different position. If you look at the debt to GDP ratio in Japan, I mean, you're well above 200%. We saw the panic when the central bank raised interest rates, or the Bank of Japan raised its interest rates last time. I mean, that caused a global strain within financial markets. So Japan in a very, very difficult situation at the moment. Their inflation is increasing, but they have very limited tools to moderate that given their high debt to GDP. The high levels of debt. So, Japan, a very different economy to China, and I think it kind of does to an extent, explain the differential, but also maybe a little bit of a move towards safe havens as well. So if you have a look at the yen was a little bit weaker today as well. So that was down 2%. So maybe not as much safe haven flow, but yeah, two very different economies. And also, like I said, you always get sort of strange pricing into the end of the month.
Very interesting developments internationally. Gary, I want to come back to local movements for a second. We got an update from SPAR. What did they have to say?
That's a SPAR, also interesting. So this was a 47 week sales update, at least, and yeah, very, very difficult environment. So it wasn't a large move in the share price on the back of the trading update. You know, stock was flat for most of the day, but it speaks to how difficult things are on the ground for SPAR. Now, SPAR is a fairly well diversified global business. So they've obviously got their operations in Switzerland as well. In franc terms, they did fairly well. So they saw a 5.8% lift in francs. You know, a 5.8% loss in francs, but a 0.8% lift in ZAR. So there was that currency translation. You know, looking at their Poland business as well, that also in zloty terms actually falling slightly. So yeah, a little bit tough there as well. Yeah, BWG, which is their Irish business, also feeling the effects, just highlighting the Brexit effect as well, just saying that things are difficult. Locally speaking, their total group revenue is up 4.1%, and obviously highlighting, you know, exchange rate fluctuation within that. But if you just strip out SPAR South Africa, sales up 3.5%, builded sales only up 1.2%. So, you know, very, very difficult operating environment. We're obviously in a high interest rate portion of the cycle, but SPAR just struggling compared to some of the other retailers, you know, the likes of ShopRite, for example. And if you look at it, part of the reason for that is their more decentralized business model. Instead of, you know, having all the corporate stores and being able to leverage that, you know, the technology around, you know, their loyalty cards, etc., you know, launching things like Pick and Pay, at least Pick and Pay ASAP or Checker 6060. SPAR finds that a lot more difficult because it's a franchise model. On the positives, though, obviously less load shedding that has fed into things, but you do get the sense that the consumer in South Africa is still very strained.
Gary, what are we looking forward to for this week? It looks as though there's a couple of US earnings reports that are starting to trickle in, not really earnings season kicking off just yet. What are we looking forward to in terms of data points?
Yeah, so it's actually a fairly big data week this week. So of course the big one is always going to be the non-farm payroll number, which is going to be out on Friday. It comes out the first Friday of every month, and we are expecting around 140,000 new jobs to be added. We're not expecting a change in the unemployment rate. So you know, the unemployment rate in the U.S. printed at 4.2%. We're expecting it to come in line again at 4.2%, and this will have a big impact on whether or not the Fed cuts interest rates by another 50 basis points or by the 25 basis point level. So currently, if you look at Fed funds futures, there's about a 40% chance we'll get another 0.5%. If that happens, we're going to see the Rand get very, very strong very, very quickly. Yeah, that's the one big, that's a big labor market number. We're going to get kind of a pre-labor market number in terms of the JOLTS job openings tomorrow afternoon at 4 p.m. That will also definitely be interesting to watch. We've of course got the Fed chair speaking this evening too, so all of this will feed into those expectations around interest rate cuts. It will move our local currency and certainly move the dollar as well. We obviously have European Union inflation out tomorrow as well. Consensus is for a further reduction in the European Union. Previously they printed at 2.2%. We're expecting that to go down to around 1.9, and then a whole raft of PMI numbers coming out throughout, just to give us a gauge of what's happening in global economies, from services to manufacturing and that. And yeah, I think the message that, you know, if I had to look at them all in composite, is that it is difficult out there. You know, we're starting to see a real slowdown given the higher interest rates and the tighter monetary policy. And you know, while you do have the likes of the ISM services PMI in the US still quite robust, still, you know, we're expecting that to print at 51.6, which is still in expansionary territory. You know, if you look at the tomorrow's ISM and manufacturing PMI, that expected to print at 47.5 in the US, showing that it's in contractionary territory. So the story that they're telling is that it is difficult out there and that there are real concerns around global growth going forward.
Certainly a lot to look forward to this week. It's going to be a busy week. We'll have to see how it all shapes up and what we make of it as the week progresses. Thank you so much, Gary, as always, for the time and for the insights. Gary Boysen, Portfolio Manager and Director at Rand Swiss, joining me to take a look at the market movements as we kick off the week.
What will you leave behind one day? Whether you're building a life for your children, building an empire, or both, your future starts with the right investment partner. 91. Investing for a world of change. 91 is an authorized FSP.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
So last week we got the stimulus package from China. They announced a big stimulus package and we were still trying to quantify how big that package was. It seems it's to the tune of around 140 billion US dollars. And we thought we'd take a look at whether or not this is exactly the move that markets have needed up to this point. I'm joined on the line by Jeremy Stevens, Chief China Economist at Standard Bank, to take a look at this and try and make sense of that stimulus package. Good evening, Jeremy. Thanks so much for taking the time. $140 billion, is that enough or is China merely delaying an inevitable problem here?
I think the question of whether it's enough is a bit of a red herring. To be honest, it's not necessarily going to fundamentally address the cyclical challenges inside the Chinese economy. But really what the authorities are doing is gradually rolling out a series of monetary and fiscal stimulus support packages to support the economy as it metabolizes and restructures. And this move is kind of exactly what the doctor had ordered. It's more support financed by the central government, focused on domestic demand and boosting sentiment, plus an additional piece that will help refinance existing debt of local governments and shift that debt onto the central government balance sheet. Up until now, direct subsidies have been sort of not in fashion. They've also been reluctant to bail out local authorities. And they've also traditionally been focusing on supporting supply rather than demand. So obviously this move is better. The fact that it's coordinated is good. It shows that the regulators and the central banks are thinking very carefully and creatively. It's no surprise that markets like it. I think that the moves on Tuesday from the monetary policy side to get the financial system ready for a surge in central governments and local government special purpose bonds is smart. I also think it's wise not to have sort of flip-flopped on the real estate sector and to rather just deal with existing homes and affordable housing. I think that this is exactly what was needed at this point. But in terms of what does it mean for the economy and whether that's enough, I think that the reality is that the challenges facing the economy remain entrenched and will continue to play out. But this does mean that the outlook is slightly better than it was at the start of last week.
Jeremy, why now? Why is China suddenly concerned with addressing deflation and getting the economy back on track? Why is this happening now?
The timing is certainly quite interesting. The Politburo tends to meet three times a year to discuss the economy. That's usually April, July, and October. Every October after they've met, there's been some kind of fiscal support coming to kind of help the economy and to maintain momentum going into the first quarter of the following year. So we expected that to happen this year. The fact that it happened in September is quite interesting. The fact that the Politburo meeting focused on the economy in September also suggests there's an urgency. So does it mean that they've seen October data and Q3 data and they recognize that economic data has deteriorated again and carried on its momentum loss? Does it mean that they think that there's something in the financial system that needs to be remedied or that they need to be on the front foot of? Does it mean that there's something happening in the property sector that they need to be on the front foot or the local government? It's hard to say, but clearly the fact that they've met now where the economy is vulnerable, it's been losing momentum for a number of months. The supply side of the economy that's been driving the recovery is losing momentum. It's also worth noting that infrastructure investment went close to zero at last month. We know that exports have benefited from very favorable base effects and are actually underwater relative to 2022. We also know that the consumer side is very weak. And last year, this time, and going through the end of last year, the data was actually relatively robust. So again, they get unfavorable base effects. And so the data could have deteriorated quite considerably this month. And so they want to be on the front foot before the data drops.
Could this be seen as an admission by China that their previous policies may have been harmful towards their economy?
I don't think that this is necessarily an admission that the previous policies were harmful. They would never admit that. That's first and foremost. But what it does recognize is that the rising call for more forceful support for domestic demand has been heard. And remember, last month, consumption fell to 2.1%, which is way below the 4% that markets were expecting. So clearly, consumers are struggling and they need to be doing more, especially for the low and middle income households in China who are facing, a sharp deterioration in sentiment. They're struggling with incomes running lower than nominal GDP growth. They're struggling with employment. I saw last week the youth unemployment number hit 20%. So there's a lot going badly for the consumer right now. Needless to say, also the fact that real estate markets have fallen for 3 years, and that's where a vast majority of their wealth sits. So, the pivot towards helping domestic demand, that's certainly welcomed. And there's a rumor that something like 800 renminbi per family for every family that has two children is being considered. So those kind of direct transfers that change people's disposable income and their spending decisions will matter. And also the fact that they're sort of working harder to convert some of the local government debt into central government debt is also smart. It's something they did last year. It's not like the first time they've done it. So it's not an accepted that what they've done in the past were harmful, but clearly it's less supply, more demand, and that's better from a structural point of view as it relates to the Chinese economy.
Off the back of this, Jeremy, we saw today that markets had their biggest day in more than 15 years. Has the spark officially been reignited?
You're right, markets are loving this. The fact that the PBOC is basically putting a floor under the stock market has really been quite a big signal to anyone and their dog that they want to be long Chinese equities. That was the biggest surprise of the press conference. Basically, they created two new facilities, a swap line so that insurers and brokers and fund managers can exchange existing stock into treasury bonds and then use those bonds and the proceeds of those bonds or the collateral on those bonds to buy more shares. So that's quite incredible. And a second sort of facility that they created, which is that the central bank will lend to banks, and then the banks can then lend the money to firms, and those firms can use that money to embark in share buybacks. So, there's a lot that's supportive for the equity markets. It's 800 billion renminbi worth so far, and they've said basically that they can expand those two programs at will or at their discretion. And so some people are saying it's 2.5 trillion renminbi worth of support for equity markets. So, absolutely, from their point of view, they've ignited stock prices. What's interesting is that they've tried to do this a number of occasions since 2015, and each time it's failed. So whether or not this works, the jury's out. But certainly to a casual observer, it seems to be that they want the stock markets to play a role in offsetting what has been a decline in wealth of the households because of real estate, and this will be a useful offset. But whether or not that occurs is going to take many, many months to see that materialize and for sentiment to improve more on a broad base level. And whether or not that happens or not, the jury's still out.
Now, some analysts might be concerned around the timing, of course, and we looked at this a little earlier about the timing. Is this China responding to the US rate cutting cycle and trying to perhaps remain attractive to global investors at this stage?
So the fact that the Fed has cut, I think, is more a coincidence, than it is now the Fed's cut, so the PBOC's cutting. I think the PBOC were reluctant to cut. I think they were instructed to cut, and so they did so. But I don't think that they're of the view that the issue is that the economy needs cheaper credit. You know, the fact is that bank loan demand's very, very low and still running faster than deposit growth, still running faster than nominal GDP growth. And so the reality is that banks, the real problem facing the authorities and their ability to cut rates is the narrowing of the net interest margin, the difference between what they charge people to borrow money and what their cost of financing is. That's narrowed dramatically. And so every time they cut rates, they have to match that with a cut to deposit rates. And that's pushing people to stop putting their money in the banking system and to find alternative places to store their cash. And really, that's what's been occupying the minds of the regulators. And so when they cut, it's difficult for them because it squeezes bank profitability. And the PBOC have been saying that for months now, that that's the big drawback. It's not the currency, it's not the Fed, it's really the viability or the profitability of the financial sector. And so it's no surprise that they announced on Tuesday that they're going to recapitalize the banking sector and the big six banks and give them a triple R cut as well. And I think that really this is about, you know, laying the foundation for a surge in central government bonds that will happen through the rest of the year. And so the banks need to be liquid and able to facilitate that process.
Certainly some interesting reflections from the Chinese perspective. We'll leave it at that, Jeremy. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Jeremy Stevens, Chief China Economist at Standard Bank.
And in your business news, Reserve Bank Governor, what's his name, has repeatedly said this and that, and policymakers are expecting rates to go up or down. With inflation somewhere between 0 and 100%, interest rate relief may come sooner or later. Who knows, really? The whatchamacallit slid into undefined territory based on the Duhigi being so-so, and the markets were hard to describe. Despite initial doubts, the outcome was a mixed bag. The rand was meh based on the US consumer prices, but sentiment towards the currency could be, you know, whatever.
You can't base a decision on imprecision. Ask your financial advisor about a guaranteed annuity from Momentum Wealth. Personalized certainty.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The South African Poultry Association has said that they would put through an application to National Treasury to have a certain chicken be regarded as a VAT-free or VAT-exempt chicken. I'm joined on the line by Francois Baird, who is the chair for the Fair Play Movement. Take a look at these developments and try and make sense of them. Good evening, Francois. Thanks so much for taking the time. Your initial thoughts around this proposal?
This is a vital proposal for the health of the nation, the health of the poultry industry, for jobs, and generally for growth in South Africa, because this is the biggest agricultural sector, namely poultry. And when you look at the need of particularly low-income households for access to meat protein, it's vividly demonstrated by the fact that you have so many children under five. 27% of children under five in South Africa are stunted because they and their mothers, pregnant mothers, don't get enough animal protein. So we think the case for certain pieces of chicken, at least, to be made free of VAT is really very important.
Francois, what would this mean from a producer point of view? What impact would this kind of have on the chicken farmers or the producers within the country and those that are exporting into South Africa?
Well, of course, when the market grows, South African producers are so competitive, they're always rated amongst the top five or six most competitive producers in the world. And so when the market grows, they'll produce more chicken. In the long run, it means that chicken could become even cheaper because economies of scale would kick in. South Africa might be getting to a position where at some point in the future it's also possible to export. That will add further growth. And therefore, this is really a vital kickstarter not only for low-income households, but also for South Africa's biggest agricultural sector. And poultry, quite frankly, is a national asset. It should be supported. The importers will take advantage, and we will be watching from Fairplay's perspective very closely to see if they're playing by the rules. They're not always keen to do that.
Francois, speaking of those rules, we already have a very stringent anti-dumping regulation in place. Do you think that this particular application that's being put forward to National Treasury would, in aggregate, enhance the overall kind of state of the local producers and their competitiveness, or is this kind of going to benefit a lot more towards the international exporters exporting into South Africa?
It will definitely benefit South African producers and South African consumers. The importers, as long as they play by the rules, provide a vital service. They are competitive too, of course. And it means as long as they're not dumping, it's a good thing to have various players in the industry. The dumping issue is different. Dumping means that they sell below the cost of production in their own countries or the price at which they sell chicken to their own consumers. And very often they do that because they've already made their profit by selling breast meat to the north and send the spare parts to South Africa for whatever they can get for it. And the middlemen are the people who make the huge money. The dumping, anti-dumping legislation or regulation is very effective when it is used. But of course, it's quite difficult because every time there is a suspicion of dumping taking place, investigations have to be done, applications have to be made. It all costs money. And the first producers affected are small farmers. So we think that small farmers in particular will also benefit from chicken being VAT-free.
Speaking of those that will be impacted by this, let's look at the impact or the cost this could potentially have on the fiscus. This would obviously result in lost taxes or in tax revenues coming down, and this might not be something that the government might be too keen on. Where do we kind of think the government might be sitting on that, understanding that they're already under a bit of pressure from a revenue collection point of view?
The detailed analysis will, of course, be completed. But when the industry grows locally, there are more taxes being paid. When anti-dumping levies are properly used, more income is there for the state as well, for the fiscus. And we have 9 countries whose producers, some of whose producers, have transgressed and are subject to anti-dumping levies. And we believe that between anti-dumping levies, growth in the market, and the proper application of anti-dumping levies, things can be equaled out for the fiscus.
So overall, this could potentially be a very good thing that doesn't cost the fiscus to implement.
This is probably the lowest cost social program that could be launched for low-income households, because they really need it. And secondly, it's a low-cost job creation effort because it will automatically happen as the market grows. In addition, there could then be greater exports, which adds further to the scale of the industry. And the bigger the South African industry, the lower the cost will be to consumers.
Well, fingers crossed that this works out in everybody's favor, because it sounds like it is a really good proposal that will be put forward. We'll have to see how it unfolds and keep an eye on that. Thank you so much, Francois, for the insights and for the time. That's Francois Barrett, who is the chair for the Fair Play Movement, on the latest application that the South African Poultry Association wants to put forward towards National Treasury.
Unleash your workforce's potential with Regent Business School, proud BBBEE Level 1 provider. Elevate your team's capabilities through crafting a future-ready workforce with top-tier accredited qualifications. Immerse your company in a culture of ongoing learning, paving the way to success. And what sets us apart? Regent's custom business programs are tailored seamlessly to your company's requirements. Visit regent.ac.za. Regent Business School. Be the future.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This interview is brought to you by Momentum Wealth. The investment world can be rather complex, and if you think about all of the changes that have happened recently with things like the introduction of the two-part system, it's always interesting to see how your investment products can be affected or what investment products might be out there for you. I'm joined on the line by the CEO of Structured Products and Annuities at Momentum, Faria Adam, to take a look at some of the products that Momentum has on offer. Good evening, Faria. Thanks so much for taking the time. We've often spoken about different kinds of products, especially where it relates to retirement planning and financial planning and wealth planning, but we don't necessarily know enough detail about what some of these products are. And I want to look at guaranteed annuities as a starting point for the types of products that investors can invest in. What is a guaranteed annuity and how is it different from a normal annuity?
So the word annuity can actually be very complicated because we talk, for example, about saving via a retirement annuity. Now, retirement annuity is really a savings vehicle where you save on a regular basis until you reach retirement age. And then you use that lump sum generally in order to buy what we call an income product. Right now, when we talk about guaranteed annuities, it's really about using a lump sum in order to convert that into an income stream. And specifically, when we talk about guaranteed annuities, the word guaranteed is very important because a client will then know exactly what income they will get and when they will receive it. So it doesn't really matter what happens in the investment markets or if inflation goes up and down or if there's depreciation of the rand or anything else. A guaranteed annuity will provide a client with a guaranteed or certain income stream and you will know exactly how much it is without any doubts.
Faria, when we look at annuities, there's also this term of life annuity and annuities that kind of have a finite term. How do you differentiate between those types of annuities and what do investors kind of need to look out for depending on what each annuity is able to do for them?
So broadly, like you mentioned, there's two broad categories of guaranteed annuities. Most of the annuities in the market are what we call life annuities. So you can buy a life annuity with money that you've saved in your retirement fund, or you can buy it with your own discretionary savings. And as the name suggests, it offers an income for as long as the client is alive. So in addition to removing the uncertainty around market returns that I mentioned earlier, a life annuity also removes the uncertainty associated with how long someone lives. So it takes away the risk of running out of money during your lifetime and the risk of actually becoming financially dependent on others. Now, it's important to remember that even this type of income can be personalized. So you can choose, for example, a growth rate to protect against future inflation. And you can also choose what we call a guarantee term, which is a minimum period for which the income will be paid. So it pays out for at least the guarantee term, but for as long as you live. The other type of guaranteed annuity is a term certain annuity. Now, the term certain annuity provides an income for a very specific period of time that you choose. For example, you can choose that you want to have an income for 5 years or 10 years, and it's not linked to how long you live. So it's paid for exactly the period that you choose. And if the client passes away during the term, that money is still paid to beneficiaries. Now, this type of proposition is actually very useful when you have a fixed timeline that you need the income for. And you could use it for yourself or, for example, as income support for a child or family member that you want to help just for that period of time.
I think what I like about the annuity product more specifically is the fact that, as you said, Faria, it does not run out for as long as the policy holder or the annuity holder remains alive, especially if we think about the fact that people are now living to longer ages and living longer into retirement. Faria, can we get this kind of product in an offshore type of product? I'm thinking about someone that might have worked abroad or someone that might be looking to hedge against the devaluation of the rand or might just be looking to have their annuity grow in a foreign kind of currency. Is that a possibility?
So these types of product lines are typically South African products, right? So like I said, most of it is really is used with money from a retirement fund. Now, remember, when you saved in your retirement fund, you saved in rands, And because we get tax deductions and we get tax benefits from saving in a retirement product, we almost convert that again into a rand income on which you pay tax. So typically in the South African market, we don't offer offshore annuities where you get an offshore income. It's a very different type of proposition for various reasons. Number one, like I mentioned, the tax. The second thing to consider also is your types of assets that hedge it. Now, South Africa, actually, we are still in an environment where interest rates are high. So the yields on guaranteed annuities also tend to be high. For example, at the moment, this week, if you had R1 million to invest in a life annuity and you were aged 60, a male aged 60, your income in the first year could be almost 11% of that R1 million. So the value and the income that you actually get is quite high. As opposed to, for various regulatory reasons, we actually only offer incomes in South African rands and not offshore.
Ferreira, what if someone isn't formally employed or someone doesn't necessarily have a set pension plan? Can they still kind of sit down with a financial advisor, put together an annuity type of product and contribute towards that on a month-to-month basis? Or do you have to be kind of doing it as part of a pension product with a pension provider?
Absolutely. So let's talk about first about the retirement savings. So a retirement annuity doesn't have to be part of any formal agreement. You don't have to be doing it via an employer. You can do it on your own. So contributing to a retirement annuity to save for your own retirement is very much a voluntary type of savings, right? But at the time that you retire, the legislation forces us actually to take at least 2/3 of that and apply to an income product. That's the one scenario. The other scenario that I want to talk about is that I mentioned that you can use either retirement savings in a life annuity or you can use your discretionary savings in a retirement annuity. So let's say you didn't contribute to any retirement fund, but you have accumulated some money, right? And you now want to convert that money into an income stream. So it doesn't come from any retirement fund. It's just a decision that you make for yourself. So you take the lump sum and convert it into an income product. And that's what we call a voluntary life annuity. It's actually a very nice proposition because you only pay tax on the interest portion of your income. So it actually works out to be a very tax efficient way when you convert the lump sum into an income stream for life.
So for anyone can access this product effectively, should people be considering the product then? If we're looking at the conversations that we kind of need to sit down and have with financial advisors, is this one of the products where you absolutely have to have this as part of your financial plan in addition to other products you might have?
I really believe so. I think that everyone reaching retirement age must consider a guaranteed life annuity, specifically for their fixed life expenses. So to put it differently, the income from a life annuity is an ideal match for expenses that you can't afford not to meet. For example, you need to pay your medical aid, your rent, your groceries, your utility bills. And once your basic expenses and the future inflation of these expenses are covered by a guaranteed life annuity, then you have the ability almost to consider more flexible income product types. But this remains a very core piece of a financial plan.
Certainly something to think about and mull over, but as Ferreira said, definitely something you want to have in your financial plan. We'll leave it at that, Ferreira. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. That's Ferreira Adam, CEO for Structured Products and Annuities at Momentum, joining me to take a look at what guaranteed annuities and other annuities might look like. This interview was brought to you by Momentum Wealth. Momentum Wealth guaranteed annuities offer you personalized control through certainty.
And in your business news, Reserve Bank Governor, what's his name, has repeatedly said this and that, and policymakers are expecting rates to go up or down. With inflation somewhere between 0 and 100%, interest rate relief may come sooner or later. Who knows, really? The whatchamacallits live into undefined territory based on the Duhigi being so-so, and the markets were hard to describe. Despite initial doubts, the outcome was a mixed bag. The rand was meh, based on the US consumer prices, but sentiment towards the currency could be, you know, whatever.
You can't base a decision on imprecision. Ask your financial advisor about a guaranteed annuity
from Momentum Wealth.
Personalized certainty.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Around this time on a Monday, we dig into personal finance. We look at various useful tips that could be beneficial to have in your back pocket when you are thinking about your personal finances. This week, we are taking a look at education insurance. What a topic. I'm joined on the line by the Managing Director at FutureWise, Arno Jansen van Vieren, to take a look at this and try and understand it. Good evening, Arno. Thanks so much for taking the time. What is education insurance and how is it different from other insurances?
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity to be on, Jimmy. Education insurance is basically just traditional life insurance reimagined. So your traditional life insurance, you'd pay a monthly premium, and if something were to happen with a premium payer, whether that's a death or a disability, then normally you'd pay out one big lump sum that the family could use. Now, in the form of education insurance, we just tailor it very specifically to education-related needs. And how that would work is a lump sum would not be paid out, but we would pay out annually to the education provider specifically, whether that's the school or a college, a tertiary institution, or other providers of education needs, to make sure that the money is ring-fenced for education.
That's quite an interesting take on it, because when I think about the life insurance, and you just think about what traditionally has been in place, as you mentioned, we kind of look at the life insurance thing and say, we'll take some money out of that to use that for the educational needs. Mm. But there's an entire product here that is a product that can be specifically directed towards educational needs. Is this something that I can set up exactly the same way as I set up any other insurance policy, or does it need any special considerations in terms of the premiums and how things are deducted and which tertiary or higher education providers I can use this on?
Yeah, so Jamil, I mean, we're trying to make customers' lives simpler and not harder. So it's a very streamlined process. To actually apply for cover, you can do it online within 5 minutes. It's a very easy sign-on, or our call center can call you. So it's a very easy sign-up. But in terms of the nuts and the bolts, the payouts are tailored for mid-range education in South Africa up to the start of private school funding. And basically the university funding, if any of the good universities in South Africa would be covered by the FutureWise education insurance payout. So we're taking the thinking work and the guessing work out of it. And as you said, with traditional life insurance, it can be used for education. But what we find normally is that there's so many debts and estate duties and executive fees and things that need to come off people's traditional life insurance, that there's normally not necessarily enough money for the day-to-day expenses and then sometimes luxuries like education and sometimes tertiary education. So you see people that are even insured that don't get their kids educated because the products don't necessarily cater specifically for education. And that's why we decided to launch something so specific and niche tailored to education.
I don't know, what about the funds themselves? I mean, typically when we think about saving for longer term things or saving for unforeseen things, yeah, especially education, because it is such a permanent thing, it does last such a considerable period of time. How do we avoid, with these kinds of products, having the funds misallocated or having the funds not available when we need them? So when the child starts school, how do we avoid kind of not that uncertainty?
Absolutely, yeah. So education savings is a very important part of any financial plan. And if you were to put away money monthly for your kids for varsity or for long-term education, it takes a lot of dedication to put that money away every month. My little daughter is 2 years old now, and my financial advisor says I need to put away 2,000 rand a month for her tertiary education. So it takes a lot of application from parents that are financially strained to actually do that. Now, the thing with insurance is you don't have to save for the long term. The risk pooling and all the people putting their money together to insure against these adverse outcomes, that's why insurance is so much cheaper than savings if it comes to actually planning for the long term. And to then direct it to your question specifically, education insurance is the reason for being is we've developed it in a way that the parents of the remaining parents or the guardians don't have to reinvest that money, manage the money themselves, draw down every year or every month, depending on the kids' education needs, and take all of that risk on themselves. At FutureWise, we manage that pot of money. It's invested in the long term to stay in line with inflation and to make sure that when your kids get to the stage where we need to pay for the education, the money is available in the fund, and it's paid out straight to the education provider at the beginning of every year to make sure that there's no hassles, no stress around it, and that the parents don't have to manage these complex calculations themselves.
It's very interesting that you bring this up, Arno, around the fact that saving for the actual long-term event or for this inevitable event that, in the case of children having to go to school, is different to the actual insurance product. Are we saying that from an insurance point of view, I can achieve the same thing for lower premiums as if I were to save directly for an educational plan in itself?
Yeah, so Jimmy, I think it's important to stand still at that question and say a balanced financial plan is the best way to go for parents out there. And your financial advisor will talk to you about traditional life insurance and around saving for your long-term needs. And we would like them to talk about education insurance as well as a third category to supplement those two. Insurance will never be something that replaces savings altogether. If nothing happens to a parent, then an insurance policy normally lapses and there's no funds available for studies. And that's why saving for a long-term need is a good idea. But generally, saving for education in the long run is way more expensive than taking out an insurance policy to achieve the same thing. So we advise people to take out insurance to make sure that if something happens to them, that the kids' education is safeguarded. And after that, if there's still money available, start saving in the long term. So it's a complement strategy. It's a supplementation. The one doesn't replace the other one.
Mm.
And then I think in addition to that, if you are buying education insurance, you also find that there are cashbacks, there are savings boosters, there are value-added benefits that parents get from day one. So you get the benefits from day one, but you're also in it for the long term and able to provide for your kids in the long term. So It's an ecosystem of planning, but insurance is the place to start.
Arno, I just want to clarify, what happens in the event that a parent takes out this kind of educational insurance, but then lives long enough to have their child go through school? What happens to this policy? Is there some benefit to having this policy in place in addition to sort of, as you said, complementing the existing financial planning that might be there? What happens in that case?
Yeah, Jimmy, so our policies are designed for shared value from day one. And also in this case, education insurance, there won't be a payout if you reach the end of your term without any life events happening. But what we've built into our policies is a cashback for parents. So every 5 years, a percentage of your premiums are paid back into a study fund or into the parents' bank accounts to be able to give value as you go through. And whether that money is put away to help save for education in the long run, or if there's needs immediately for the kids' education, then that's a good supplement. And then we've also launched a very innovative learning hub that we've broken up into a parent hub and a student hub, where parents get up to 8,000 Rand worth of value for their kids in terms of coding support, learning support, tutors, online classes, and it's basically an ecosystem around learning. So if nothing happens to a parent, which is the best case scenario for a child, firstly, then we still give back cashbacks and we still have these value-added benefits from day one to help you on your education journey. So that's the way we try and provide value, even if that policy were to lapse without a claim in the long run.
Educational insurance, something worth considering when you are speaking to your financial planner. Have conversations with your financial planner about your future, your children's future, and how to best prepare for that. We'll leave it at that. Arno, thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Arno Jansen van Vieren, who is Managing Director at FutureWise, joining me to take a look at educational planning.
My name is Katie Ananina of Plan B Password, and I'll be on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast with Kieran Ryan talking about Portugal Golden Visa Program, which has just been amended to allow Bitcoin investment as a route to EU citizenship. This is a fascinating development for anyone interested in investing in Bitcoin and obtaining a second password. Please join us to find out more.
Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And we've come to the end of our show, but we've also come to the end of our month of September. It's been quite an interesting month of movements. We look forward to the month of October. We've got quite a bit of data points that will be coming out as we kick off kind of the last 3 months of the year. If you've missed any of our conversations, be sure to catch up online. All of the conversations are put up on our websites. They are on the MoneyWeb website, moneyweb.co.za. They're available on the MoneyWeb app. They're available on the SABC app. It's coming up to 7 o'clock, which means Greg Host is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the top sport team. From my side, good night.